Actually, why don't we just start, and I'm going to kind of quickly, somewhat quickly go through, just take us through what we did last week. So let yourself just get into a really comfortable position. Take some deep breaths. You can get into a position where you can really let your body relax and know that you can stay in that position for a while without cramping up or feeling in pain. And just for this few moments, we're just kind of giving a gift to our body, allowing it just to completely relax in your presence. And in your presence is somebody who really is grateful for even having this body, all that it does for you. How much work it does for you. And let your body just relax in that feeling of respect and appreciation and gratitude. Take some deep breaths and just let the body continue to deepen its relaxation. Just verbalizing words, keeping mentally verbalizing words, actually tell your body how much you appreciate it and how grateful you are for all that it does 24/7 for you. What an extraordinary vehicle it is. See if you can actually put it into words, not just feelings, but actually feelings with the words. So thank you. See if you can say the same words of thanks and appreciation to your sense organs, and let yourself, as you're doing that, just become aware of your sense organs. Acknowledge them. See, and you can hear that you have a sense of touch, smell, taste. And do the same for your mind. Let your mind, as we relax our body and appreciate it and our sense organs and appreciate them, notice your mind. Just notice how your mind is, what it is, how it thinks, how it feels. It imagines, it perceives. Amazing. Just let the mind be the incredible instrument that it is in your presence, a presence that appreciates and feels grateful. Give some gratitude to the unconscious also, which is part of your mind, the unconscious and the defense system. Your unconscious and your defense system are holding at bay so many things that would be overwhelming, perhaps, were they all to be let out at once. Just experience the mind as you relax. Whatever it happens to be doing, just experience it with a sense of wonder and gratitude. Your mind might have some concerns or worries or things that need to be done, or things that just the conscious mind wants to tell you. It may have a to-do list that it wants to make sure that you're not going to forget. Now that you're starting to meditate, you may forget all of these things. So just ask your conscious mind if there's anything it wants to remind you of, so that it won't have to carry that burden. I can just tell you now. Can you say, is there anything you want to tell me? Remind me. Spend a few moments addressing your unconscious as we did last week. What I'd like you to do is just relax and kind of evoke that inner friend. And actually view your unconscious as a community. It can have a lot of child parts, a lot of different parts that are there inside, actually waiting for you to come and address them, to come into a relationship with them. And you can actually just simply ask, addressing whoever may be there, you can simply say something like, does anyone inside have anything to say? And you say that from an attitude of respect and warmth and care, an attitude that doesn't evoke any fear. Does anyone inside have anything to say? And then see if anyone inside has anything to say. And be a good listener and ask for more. Is there anything else? And there may be more than one. Sometimes a lot of little ones raise their hands inside all at the same time. And it helps if you can. Whatever you say, you do have to fulfill it. Don't say something that's not true, but you could say, I will speak to everybody, I'll talk with everybody, I'll give you all some attention, even if we don't get to do it right now, I won't forget you. Because sometimes the unconscious feels this is the little ones inside that split off parts. I've been waiting a long time. And then if you disappear without having connected, that can be kind of re-traumatizing. It's all Jung, what Jung has to say, taking your all the whole inner family, you know, seriously. Don't feel that it's not real. So I spend some time coming into relationship. Does anyone inside have anything to say? you to come into relationship, and all of the little ones inside, you can invite them also. I want you to come into relationship with Ishwara, your Ishta Devata, a wisdom figure, a deity, whoever is either your Ishta Devata, your wisdom figure, or the form of the Lord that you worship, or the Ishwara himself, or the goddess. Where you pray to, and all the little ones inside can be involved in this. I'd like you to just come into relationship with Bhagawan in whatever form that is for you. And in your prayer, I'd like you to pray in a particular way, and in the way that you usually pray, but in this one particular way I'd like you to try, where you say mentally to Bhagawan, all of your aspirations are, all of the things that you want to accomplish now, or in your whole life, whatever it is that you want to be, that you want to become, that you want to achieve, small things and big things. Everyone might say they want a new bike. Don't censor. See if you can actually say all of those things. And then all of those things also that you worry about. And even if there's any thing you want to say about Bhagawan, maybe you're mad at Bhagawan. See if you can say the things that would be real, to have a real relationship where you're not censoring. When I was a little girl, I used to be told to pray, now I lay me down to sleep, and God bless Mom and Dad and all of that. It was never really okay to have a real relationship and say what I was really wanting or needing or worried about. So, see if you can spend some time in that type of prayer. so let me talk a little bit about this, because I also want to kind of give you more words about what we're doing and what we're moving toward. So the first part is what we did last week. And I think actually as that relationship, like for instance that type of relationship with your body, becomes just your relationship with your body, you know, where there's a certain respect and kind of a respect and a care where you have a friendship and good intentions for it. You don't take it for granted. And that's just natural to you. That's how you are. But it's not how we are. So we have to become that way. Unless it really is how we are. But once you come into that kind of relationship with your body actually relaxes. And you relax also in that relationship. You know, so when that's the case, that's simply how you are, and you can, every morning when you do that, your practice, you just bring that to the forefront. Kind of so that you don't forget. It's just giving a special moment, you know. And the same is that respect and friendship toward and appreciation toward your mind and your sense organs, because the mind, even when it's having tension and sorrow and all of these things, it is your mind, it's this instrument that you have that is handling all of this. And your unconscious and your defense system, this whole instrument is something incredible, what it does for you. And so to come into a relationship of appreciation, and it goes into appreciating the fact that the mind is producing these thoughts or these feelings or these imaginations or these insights. These are being given, they're being produced, you know, and they're being, not only are they being produced, they're being handled. Like for instance, when you're angry or when you're having, you know, sorrow or sadness or all of these so-called negative emotions, your mind is having to process and handle all of that, you know. And so just the appreciation to the complexity of this instrument, so that it becomes your friend rather than your enemy. If there's a relationship, we don't usually have a relationship with it really. It just is me and what I'm doing right now. But in fact, it's an instrument that you're using all the time and that you're aware of. So coming in to that type of benign relationship where you have respect and friendship and wishing well, you know, like a good friend, that gives a different relationship with the body, at least bringing that into consciousness. You start having a relationship with your body and your sense organs and mind. It's not just you. It's an instrument. Okay, so then that's just, once that just becomes normal for you, then when you sit down to meditate, you just bring that to mind, and it takes 3 seconds, or 5 seconds, 5 minutes, or whatever. But right now, when you start that, you just spend a little bit of time developing a relationship that you haven't developed before. Developing a way of being with this upadhi that you may have not done before. Then you know that laundry list? You know, I actually, today when I did that, the laundry list, like to your mind, is there anything you want to remind me of? You know, is there anything, you know, that you don't want me to forget and all of these things, or anything, you know, is there anything? And wow, the list just started. I had about 10 things on the list. And my mind will actually tell me and go through the list. And I'll say, okay, I'm going to do that, and yes, I will do that, and you're right, I do have to do that. But you know what, when you go through the list like that, the mind that is carrying that list for you can relax. Okay, she knows. This is funny, but it's true. Okay, she knows, or he knows what it is. So, okay. So now we can relax for a while. We've passed it on. So part of the mind passes that on, and then it can relax, and it can enjoy, be part of this meditation. So that's just taking care in those few, literally in those few moments, just, and even this thing about getting very, very comfortable. That's another thing about meditation. At least I always had this idea that to meditate I had to be in some sort of lotus position or something. And so, of course, within like 2 or 3 minutes, my knees hurt. And you actually, that's fine to work on your asanas and get a good posture for yourself. But when you're meditating, it would be nice if you could just really let your body relax. The Swamiji used to say, you know, like, let the body relax to the point that you don't feel it. And you can't do that when your legs are hurting, you know. So you want to be in a posture. If you need back support because your back isn't strong enough, you can work on making your back strong enough when you work on that, but not when you're meditating. When you're meditating, you know, then have back support if you need it. And work on it, doing your yoga asanas and exercises and things to build up those muscles so that you can relax without back support. But when you want to meditate, you know, then get yourself into a comfortable position so that your body can feel, I'm in a really comfortable position. Not lying down. Swamiji always said, don't lie down, because lying down means going to sleep. So these are really simple things. The other thing, these are kind of repeating from last week. Now, the other thing I talked about was not... in this type of meditation, don't set this time limit or this... You have to meditate now. You're going to sit for meditation for 1 hour or for half an hour. That is a discipline. That is a practice. You can do that as a practice. Let's see if I can sit quietly for 1 hour. That's like it's some sort of a discipline. I want to see if I can do that. Every day I'm going to do that. I'm going to build up a certain strength of mind in order to do that. But now, at this one that I'm talking about now, is not a discipline like that. You're not trying to accomplish something for an hour. And you can do that too, but not with what I'm talking about right now. Now this is a time for you to be with yourself. Yeah. And when you put all these type of restrictions on it, that doesn't really work. Okay, I have to be with myself for an hour. You know, it's kind of like, oh boy. Now, so there shouldn't be a time, it could be 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, doesn't make any difference. It's just, this is your time. So we go through this, then you start coming into relationship with the unconscious, because the unconscious, those parts, Jung always views these parts as autonomous, you know, autonomous parts of yourself that are just waiting there. They're little split-off parts that have happened when you were growing up, especially at a young age. And so by coming into relationship with them, there's a lot of energy in the unconscious, you know, and they're just waiting. So that's why a lot of people, you know, they have the experience of when they ask, does anyone inside have anything to say? There'd be like 10 people all... you know, wanting to say something. So, coming into that friendship with these parts inside and really listening and feeling, the unconscious has a lot of emotion in it. You know, all of these, the unconscious carries your emotions, you know, stored emotions. And so when you actually address it with friendship, where it's not an attack, where that the unconscious trusts you, you know, trust that you're not going to hurt it, it will start talking and will start feeling. You know, they're little, you can view them as just little child parts inside. Let them come into relationship with you and keep doing that until that's normal for you. That you're unconscious, that you have a relationship with all those parts in the unconscious. When you first start with this, all these little parts, all these little ones inside, have been holding a lot for a long, long time. And so once you come into relationship, it takes a while before everybody said and felt everything that there is to be said, you know. It does come, there can come a time where you go inside, does anybody have anything to say? No, everything's okay. Or the next day it may not be. But there's that relationship. Rather than just a hurt feeling or something inside's not quite right, there's you going in to be with that. You know, and so these parts will talk to you, and what you find then is that the silent abiding of your mind is much deeper. It goes deeply, you know, like clear water goes down deep. And so you feel an inner peace, not just the surface, not just the surface water, but you feel a depth of peace because you're into relationship and there's somebody there for all of the, for the deeper parts of the unconscious, the shadow parts of the unconscious, as Jung would say. And so that's very helpful. But now, so this is what we did last time, and I want to, so, and we did a little, we did this time also. But the thing, now, so we're going to change a little bit. What we did was your ego, your conscious mind, and all of this is coming, your conscious mind is coming into relationship and friendship with the body, with the mind, with the sense organs, with the buddhi, with the manas, with the conscious mind, and then the buddhi with the all the unconscious parts. But your buddhi and the attitude of the buddhi as a good friend is holding all of these parts, coming into relationship with all these parts. But the buddhi also, it needs to be held. You know, like it's the good parent or it's the deity, really, to all of these parts. But the buddhi needs to be held.
Mm.
Right? And so now the buddhi needs to come into relationship with Bhagawan, or whatever Bhagawan is for you. It can be many different things. You could, your Ishtadevata, the Lord that you evoke, or the wisdom figure, or the deity, you know, it doesn't have to be Ishwara. It could be a deity, a wisdom figure, whatever it is, the divine, whatever it is that is greater than yourself, that holds you. Then you can come into that prayerful relationship with that, which is bigger and more powerful and more all-embracing of the buddhi. You see what I mean? It's like the buddhi, it's what holds the buddhi, the divine that holds the buddhi, that holds the mind. And so now, what type of relationship do you have with that in terms of prayer, when you think of prayer? You can have chants, a lot of chants in Vedanta. I have lots of chants that I do and can do and like to do. So, and when I was little, I had lots of just prayers. But now I lay me down to sleep variety of prayers. God bless mommy and daddy and all of this. It goes on and on and on. But that's all, nothing wrong with it. But what about, I want and need this, and this is what I'm trying to do, and this is what I'm aspiring for, and this is where I need some help, and this is where I'm falling short, and whatever it is, what's real. And if you start, I find for myself, when I just kind of go through that, also my psyche gives me a lot of what it really is I do want. And what is, if there's something that is bothering me, the buddhi, not the little ones inside, the little ones inside can all be saying, I'm praying a lot too. But what is it that, where are you in this life? What are you looking for? What are you wanting? What kind of help do you want? You know, how are you feeling about Bhagawan today? You think about it, and Swamiji's talked about this too. It's like, you know, you have a relationship with your partner, your loved one, and you wouldn't do a now I lay me down to sleep with your partner. You know, you would be talking about things that are meaningful to you, the day-to-day stuff, but also, you know, what is really happening. If you have a good relationship, you know, otherwise you're just closed off and it's a really unfulfilling relationship. But if you have a good relationship, you're going to be talking about the things that matter to you. You know? And so with Bhagavan, also, I would say, like, if the relationship is there, it would be include the things that really matter to you, big or small. And that there's nothing wrong with wanting a new bike. There's nothing wrong with wanting a new job, or this or that. All these things that we dismiss, especially for a lot of us, it depends, like, kind of the Protestant ethic. Or how I was brought up, it's like, God is too busy to be bothered. You know, God is too busy to be bothered with these silly little things that you want. Don't take his time with those type of things, you know. You just ask, if you're asked for anything, you should ask for the big things, like, may all beings be happy. You know, may we have world peace. You know, may you look kindly upon all beings. And these are prayers for that. There's nothing wrong with these prayers. But what if that's all that you feel that you have the right to do? And I know that. I know from all the years of teaching at CIS that actually, and from my own students, that those feelings are there. You know, that it's not all right to have that real type of relationship. So all these kind of restrictions are put up, and so that really means that there's you have a closer relationship with your partners and friends than you do with Bhagavan. And actually, there is no closer relationship than your relationship with Bhagavan. So is that expressed or is it not expressed? It should be able to be expressed in any form that you want. There shouldn't be somebody coming from the outside saying you can only talk to Bhagavan in this way. Yeah. And at the same time, you can have so many prayers and so many rituals and so many chants and so many pujas and so many ways of expression. But it should include all of the things, the personal ones also. And it just is a way of bringing the psyche into, so that you're not alone in this creation. Because, so this is just on a level of just personal prayer with Bhagavan, with Ishvara. You know, when I say Ishvara, I mean whatever form, or wisdom figure, or deity, or what doesn't make any difference. It's just who is the divine for you. You know, everything that I've just said, this is all just precursor to meditation. We're not even meditating yet. It's just precursor, all attitudinal. And what we haven't done, because there's a whole other thing I'll be working on more next week, what we haven't done is we've only worked inside my relationship to the body, mind, sense organs, the little ones, etc., and then my relationship, my relationship with Bhagavan. Next, we have to work on our relationship with everyone in my life, all of the people in my life, all of the inner relationships that I have. You know, but it's kind of like, you know, in the plane, and they say, you know, put on your mask first, and then put on your child. So, first we put on our mask and get ourselves situated, and then we're actually in a disposition, a meaningful disposition, to come into relationship with the people in our life. Because if you go through the people in your life, the inner circle, and then the kind of outer circle, you'll think, well, and parents, and people who have died. This one's fine, this one's fine, this is fine, that's, and there'll be one. So we have to put this on. I'll do a guided meditation on this person that is in my life, you know. There's a tension between us. And so I have to work on releasing that. See what I mean? So all of these things that we're doing now are actually, for now, precursors that we'll be doing are now precursors to meditation. But after a while, they're not precursors to meditation because they're just how you are. this is how you live your life. You know what I mean? And then, so you just bring all of that to mind, and then you do meditation. But just think about what we're actually doing when we meditate. We are in Vedanta. I mean, there's a lot of so many different types of meditation. But what we're doing really is bringing the mind to a just to the recognition that happens really at the time of teaching, to where I just sit with my own being, and then I recognize my own being as Brahman, and then I recognize myself as this entire creation. But I have to be in a disposition to do that in a way that is real for me. If my mind is still preoccupied with so-and-so and so-and-so, or the little ones are inside are all hurting and crying because nobody's asked them what's wrong, or my mind has a whole laundry list, or my knee is hurting, or, you know. All of these things don't allow for me to just sit in that space of knowledge, which is nididhyasana. What we call nididhyasana. It's a space that allows me to just sit in this vision, to let my mind just totally sit in the vision. But to do that, we have to do a little preparation. And the preparation is actually your life, but, you know, but all of these things, all of these type of exercises become natural to you in your life. And in the meantime, you can make them become natural to you in the time you're sitting in meditation to meditate. Okay, so that's what we're doing. Now, another thing is I'm just giving you a sequence, and we're working with it. I expect for everybody, including this way for myself also, you'll take each one of the things that I'm talking about, and you'll make it your own in your own way. You know, inside. You get the idea, what we're doing, and then you have your own way of doing that. You'll find you're making your own little adjustments and your own order of things. Mm-hmm. And what is necessary for your psyche at this particular time or that particular time. You have all of these, you understand all of these things, and then you probably have some of your own also. See what I mean? But it's just, if you understand the spirit of it, you're really coming into a loving, caring relationship with all parts. And then you're allowing your buddhi to be held by Bhagavan. You're letting Bhagavan come into a loving relationship with your buddhi, or you come into that, and then your buddhi is, you know, taking care of all these other parts. And then once that is kind of complete, then you can look out and take care of all of the parts in the world, inside, outside. Make sense? So, that's good enough for let's just say a prayer, and then we'll just have a little satsang. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
The end of that prayer, Sri Guru Vyanamaha, what is that saying?
Hari Om is just evoking Bhagavan as Hari, and Om, which is the name for the whole, for everything. Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. My salutations to the Guru, and Guru Pyo can be taken as respect, because sometimes your teacher, when you evoke your teacher, your guru, they'll put it in the plural, just as a sign of respect. But it can also be namaha, salutations, and guru bhyaha is in the dative case, to all of the teachers that have come before me. We have some chants like that that go back through the whole lineage. Because if a teacher has to have been taught himself or herself, and that goes back, so salutation to the whole lineage of this teaching. So Shri, and Shri is a, what do you call respect? So Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Hari Om. So it just starts with Hari Om, which is evoking Bhagavan. And Om is always a blessing. I mean, we'll always start sipping with Om just to evoke that blessing. So Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Shri Guru Pyaha Namaha. Salutations, my namaskars to that beginningless tradition of teaching. It's called the Sampradaya. The Sampradaya is teacher, student, teacher, student, teacher, student, how it goes on in the creation. They say that Bhagavan is the first teacher, like Lord Dakshinamurti is the first Shiva or Ishwara manifest as the first teacher is Dakshinamurti. And then as long as the creation is manifest, that teaching will continue. That's in the tradition. So even in Kali Yuga, when nobody cares about it except for a handful of people, that's the kind of the most, the darkest of the three, of the four yugas. Still, this knowledge won't perish. It'll always be there for the mumuksha. That's what it said. So it's the pranams to the lineage. That not just lineage, the sampradaya, the flow of the teaching.
So, I worked with this past week, what you taught last week, and two things. One, I found that so far there's just pretty much one
little
split
one.
Off part. it seems to be sort of beginningless, to not really have a story attached to it. And I don't know whether that's because I'm numb to it or if it really is from, if it is beginningless or doesn't have a story, I came with that split off part, in other words.
Or it could be just really, it's a feeling, you can tell that it's there.
Yeah.
But there's no words, just feeling.
There is a word, or, three words or so, and I can track it back to, I don't want to sound weird, I can track it back to, being in utero.
Oh, that's interesting.
But not before that, and at that point, there's not a story, there's, a location.
Yeah, and just a feeling in
a
utero,
location.
In the womb.
There's, a feeling and a location, but no story. So at that point, I had this idea, there'll be a story, this happened, because of the way that you were explaining it, and then it'll resolve, because I'll know the story, and it's there's, so then I was just sat with it.
Okay.
So that what I should do?
Yeah.
Be with
and in fact, there's what they say just in psychology, and I've had this experience, as have many others. There's parts that are split off from the child that are pre-verbal. And in that case, if say you were crying away, and nobody heard you and you cried for too long, that type of thing, And so there was a part that was traumatized, as an example, but you can actually just be with that part and just feel it and hold it. Imagine yourself holding it, and even talking to it or singing to it, just in imaginally. Because, the psyche, the unconscious, is imaginal and feelings. And so you can actually just be with that part and say, I can feel you, or you feel, whatever comes naturally. And just do that. And also they won't always have a story, but they might be crying or worried about something or afraid of something, and it may evoke in you the story, or they might tell you the story, tell you what happened, or they just might want to be comforted, Or they might be, sometimes those little parts, say you're having problems in an important relationship. Like your partner or good friend or whatever, or a parent or anything, important relationship. Then you go and talk to those little parts, those little ones inside, and they can be, or that one can be feeling very hurt that mommy doesn't love me, or, you know, or even say in your love relationship, a little part, little one can be feeling hurt because daddy doesn't love me. And then you have to say something like, well, that's something that happened back then, but that's not who this guy is or this person is. You know what I mean? So what I'm saying is what's happening out here in this time and space can trigger the emotions of the little ones inside who are feeling hurt. And they can as though superimpose those feelings and emotions onto the person that you're relating to now. And that's why, that's another reason why it's so helpful to go inside. Like, say you feel say you're in a relationship, in the personal relationship, in a romantic relationship, or all the other types of relationships that can evoke feelings from you. You know? So say a feeling is invoked, and you just assume that the feeling belongs out here because this person has evoked that feeling. But often, if the feeling is out of proportion at all, it's very helpful to go back inside and be with that feeling. And say, you can say something, you know, what is this really? Are you talking to the feeling? What is this really about? What is it really happening? And then that part will often tell you, and you go, that's right. And it kind of removes the pressure off of this situation, even though that situation could have some legitimacy also. But it's that too much hurt, too much irritation, too much anger that's not necessary. Yeah. But that's what's been triggered. So you can go back and have a relationship. You get used to not assuming that your feelings are necessarily belonging to what's actually going on out here. So your mind is used to going inside as well as outside, you know. And then you get a lot more relief. There's a lot more space inside.
Well, when you go inside like that, are you supposed to administer first aid? What are you supposed to do with the
Well, you know, emotional first aid. Emotional first aid is, if you're, what do we want, you know? When you're really feeling hurt, when you're feeling hurt or sad, that part would love to have some comfort, to be comforted, you know, to be understood, to be accompanied in some way, you know?
Yeah, the last thing you want is for someone to say that, you know, no, you're not feeling that, or, you know, snap out of it.
Yeah.
That's the last thing you want.
Yeah, that's true. So a lot of times also when we feel hurt, or we also feel isolated, there's an, you know, it's when you're feeling really, really hurt that everybody tends to go away. When you're feeling, when you have those feelings inside, you can actually, your buddhi, you know, you, the buddhi, not the atma, the atmas, that's another level that we will get to, you know, you can actually go in and be with that part, so that it's not, you're not isolated. The part that's feeling so hurt is not isolated. You can be there as a good parent, as a good mother, as a companion, as somebody who cares. Mm-hmm. And I think that, see, your buddhi, the one who has so much knowledge and so much experience, the buddhi learns how to function in the world, to hold the world of experience, the external world of experience, but it also needs to, and is learning now, at least what we're talking about now, learns how to be with and hold the internal world of emotions and feelings and, you know, experiences.
is that kind of what they mean when they talk about emotional intelligence? Is
that, well, that's, I haven't read that book, actually. I have that book, but I haven't read it yet. It makes sense that, I mean, that to me would be emotional intelligence, where, you know, it's 360 degrees, you know, in every direction, even toward the divine, toward God, toward Bhagavan. You know, that there's a real relationship. And also, if you use the word emotional intelligence, you know, we don't want to be unhappy. We don't want to be isolated. Human beings don't want that. You know, none of us. We don't want to be disrespected. You know? And so, even, you know, Swamiji's talked about this, that the very natural, you don't have to be taught Dharma. You know, you learn Dharma is very natural, that doing to others, you know, as I would have done to myself, that's innate. You know, you want to be respected, so you have to respect other people. It's kind of like putting two and two together. It's not a big deal. It's something that you do know. We don't have to teach you, so you go out and memorize the Dharma rules. You know, it's you want to be respected, you want to be loved, you want to be given the benefit of the doubt, you want to be helped when you're hurting, all of these things. And so we know that that's what's being called upon. We're being called upon to do that also. Just naturally. And so one of the things that so much gets in the way of our even being able to do that externally is that we don't do it internally. And so there's too much hurt inside to be able to have the room to hold others. We don't even, because we don't hold ourselves, all the parts inside.
Well, when we go to say there's a painful or hurt there that's not verbal, and you want to hold it with your mind and be a companion there, so it's not alone, then are you there to care for it and to heal it? Or, I mean, some of these things seem to be permanent. And what is the...
you know, the idea of things being permanent, there's some truth in that, but it has to be, it's true and not true. Mm-hmm. When I was doing some work with that union analyst I worked with so many years, his name is Larry Jaffe, he told me a story by another therapist, well-known psychologist, I can't remember his name now, but it was in the context of his saying that, you know, the childhood scars and wounds that we have, it's not that you they completely go away.
No.
They don't completely go away. But, you know, the woundedness of them, there's a scar left, but not kind of all of the blood and pus and pain, you know, vibrating pain that goes around. But that scar is still left, which gives you a certain character, gives you your personality, you know, and your sensitivities and things like that. He told the story of this, in this palace, there were two beautiful china vases that were both on the sides of the door, one on this side, one on this side, and they were on these, you know, nicely carved little tables. Each vase had its own table, and they were identical, you know, and they were big too, like shaped kind of like this. So they were absolutely precious. They were like a precious stone, so they were so beautiful. But one had been knocked over and had broken into many, many pieces. You know? And they had to call in a master craftsman who spent a long time repairing it, piece by piece by piece. But when it was finished, if you looked even close up at these two vases on either side, you could not tell which one had been broken. You couldn't tell. But the vase could tell. it had gone through an experience. Even though it was whole, But it had gone through something that the other had not gone through. Yeah. And so it's not as though you lose your past and you lose all of these, you lose all of these experiences, and you don't lose certain sensitivities that are brought about by those experiences. You know, but you're also whole. And the experiences, the there's thin scars there, but without the wounded, without the wound. You see what I mean? The scars aren't bleeding, but they're still there. You know? And so you'll have certain areas of sensitivity where another person may not have that sensitivity. And I mean sensitivity where you're, where you have to be a little bit protective, where you're aware of that sensitivity in yourself and you know how to handle it. Or another person may not have that sensitivity at all. There's no scar there. There's no wound at all. Nothing. But they have their own. Everybody has their own, you know, their own set of experiences that from infancy, you know, that have affected your character. You know, you're not a clean slate. You can say, well, you're born as a clean slate, so to speak, with lots of slavrabda karma and vasa and everything. that already colored, conditioned, clean slate then is very affected in its relationship with the world. You know, with the community that you find family, you find yourself in the world.
Sounds to me like this process, it's very permissive in a way, and that the guiding the thing that guides it is your own sense of what feels right. Because for me, and there's a context for this, which is practicing with this, have a tendency to go like on these journeys into other worlds, and there's other beings and creatures. It's, you know, like drugs, but without the drugs. And it's this whole big thing. And then also another thing that came up for me that you haven't really described, but that these little parts can have relationships with each other. And, you know, there can be a whole the dramas and, you know, things going on in that way.
Yeah, you're getting into imaginal realms of the psyche, and if you're entering into that, that's actually called, what Jung will call active imagination. And there are inner relationships and those type of things. If they're starting to get into that, then there's no... If there's any warning to be given about that, it's simply that in the end, whatever the relationship is and whatever territory that you're getting into, that you, the Buddhi, are the one who holds the Dharma. You're responsible for anything that you bring back with you, any type of acting out, it's the Buddhi that has to say yes or no. So Jung talks about that because it can be important when people, say, have a psychotic break, for instance, that Buddhi is no longer there saying yes or no. It will succumb to the voices in that very imaginal realm. The imaginal realm of the unconscious. You can enter into the imaginal realm of the unconscious, and the parts of the unconscious can say, well, I think you do this. You know, and the Buddha goes, okay. Yeah. And you makes this statement. He says, you are the one, you know, with your understanding of Dharma, with your moral compass, that has to be, in the end, the one who says yes or no. Because from a Jungian standpoint, even some of the divine figures, wisdom figures, can have a shadow side. You know, so who is speaking? So it's up to you to decide that. Even when we do, which we haven't talked very much about this, but when you're engaged in inner dialogue and you're writing down, which can be very effective. Say you're into a dialogue with some parts, inner parts, and you write down something, what you say, and then you write down what the inner part says. And you can even, if you're typing, you can do one in caps and one in small letters, just to to be able to distinguish between the two. If you do something like that, you'll find that your psyche has a tremendous amount to give you. You know, and you just let it come. You don't censor it all. You just write whatever it's saying, and just you don't think, well, is that me talking or is that the unconscious? Don't even bother. You just let yourself do that process. And then when you read it over, often you'll be surprised at all of the things that come out, you know. But say you're doing that, and can be very enlightening, actually, in certain ways. Say you're doing that, you can do that same type of dialogue with God or with a wisdom figure. And just be asking questions, and what about this, and what about that, and see what when you're coming into dialogue with that level, what it says. But then when you read it over, it's you that has to say, that makes sense, that doesn't. You see what I mean? So you let go of all control in a way, but then in the end, when you evaluate it, you have to make a judgment call based upon your own moral compass. And that allows you the freedom to really travel around and then see it. So. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to... I have difficulty having a visual relationship.
It doesn't have to be visual. It can be feeling, it can be auditory. Not everybody has visual. Yeah. What was yours? Just more feeling?
Yeah, it was more of like a sense, which comes very naturally, but it's not associated with any kind of image.
It doesn't have to be. It can be... just a sense with even no words, but it can be a sense in just words, or feelings with images, feelings without images, just auditory. So there's no rules, and everybody's psyche is a little bit different. Sometimes they'll categorize people as, you know, the way that they are, the relationship is often visual, the relationship is auditory, the relationship is more kinesthetic. Depends on the person. Yeah.
I did have one other question about meditation practice, because you had talked about being sort of in an uncomfortable position that might draw your attention back. But I've often had the opposite experience, where I've had really like pleasurable sensations in meditation, and sort of feel the same though, that it kind of draws me back away from whatever my other intention that I have. So I was wondering.
Well, you know, I haven't heard that so much about having the body actually giving pleasurable sensations, but they do say in kind of the Vedantic tradition, which I think is probably much bigger than that actually, that there are four major types of obstructions when you're meditating. One is just, you know, the agitated mind. You know? Another is wanting to fall asleep. So with an agitated mind, you can't focus, or you're wanting to fall asleep. The third one is called kashayas, where stuff is just rising up from the unconscious. But the fourth one is pleasure. You know, so say for instance, you're saying your body is just feeling such a good sensation that it draws you out. But it does even when your mind is feeling some bliss state, it draws you into that bliss state, you know. But you know, like say like when we did at the beginning, and so just, you know, relax, let yourself get into a really comfortable position, and just let yourself enjoy that. I would actually let yourself enjoy it, you know, and just appreciate it, you know, and be grateful for it. And do that for a little while, and then move on, rather than trying not to have that experience. I think even with bliss states in the mind, those bliss states, there's nothing wrong with a bliss state, right? But the only problem with it is that it is a state of mind. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that you can't be with that bliss state and just enjoy it for some time, and then you'll actually, it'll take care of itself. You know, and then you can just move to it's the ananda of yourself, which is really responsible for the mind having that bliss state in the first place. And so if you just don't try to control it, Just let it be for a while. Then you can just easily move into what is really the self of the bliss state. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I don't know. I feel the danger there of being like chasing after that feeling. I feel like it's a physical sensation, but it's also a,
Well, like, let's look at it for a minute. What would happen if you chased after the feeling? What would happen?
Well, it just seems like then you I don't know, that you lose control of it a little bit, that it becomes more about achieving a certain state instead of...
Oh, so you mean you're afraid that yeah, that you'd become like an addict to the bliss state, or an addict to the physical sensation. If that's all you knew, I think that maybe so, because then you would think that that's what your meditation is about. But you don't think that, or you're, at least as you're coming here, you won't be thinking that.
So, you better not be thinking that.
but what I'm saying really is that you'll know that there's something more. See, say if you think that, oh, here's the bliss state, and this is what I'm supposed to be going after, is this bliss state, then you just will try to continue going after it. That's the problem. Not the bliss state isn't the problem. It's that now I think, oh, here's the bliss state, let me go after the bliss state, let me have more and more and more of the bliss state. And that's like the dangling carrot. You see what I mean? But having just that, enjoying that bliss when it's there, or enjoying the positive physical sensations while they're there, is fine, as long as you don't think that's what you're supposed to be doing in order to proceed. You see the difference?
Yeah.
Because then you can really enjoy those little gifts. The gift of a blissfully comfortable body, and a mind that is shining. These are gifts. But they're not there. In the end, you want to enjoy all of those, but have a relationship, the mind have a relationship, a recognition of the ananda that never comes and goes. Bliss states come and go. Physical body, pleasurable states come and go. The ananda of your being never comes and goes. So once that's differentiated, then it's not something that's ever going to go away. So that's what we want to recognize. And then then we have to work on our mind and get the attitudes, work on the attitudes and learn how to be with the unconscious material. And that all takes place in time, in the light of our knowledge.
Well, that was what was so interesting, that when you started the being grateful to have a mind and grateful to have a body, to gain this knowledge, to understand the self.
Well, that's true, yeah. I mean, it's considered, that's another
blessing,
thing.
Huh?
It's considered in the Shastra an incredible punya, crores and crores, that's how the verse goes, crores and crores of punya. To be born as a human being. Because just think of how many living creatures there are counting, all the insects, and flies and mosquitoes, and all living creatures just on this planet, to have a human birth where you can actually gain knowledge is considered very, very rare. Crores of punya. And then to have a viveka, have a buddhi, and then to have mumukshutvam. So it goes like this. It becomes more and more and more rare, so they are just, for mumukshus, they try to make you appreciate yourself as a mumukshu, that it's what a gift it is, what a rare thing it is to be a mumukshu, and that to be have a human birth with a buddhi, with mumukshutvam, very, very rare, so to honor it and to honor this life,
Can I just ask, what was the third category of obstruction?
Sleep. There was Kshaya. That's the unconscious material coming up.
So you should see this as, if you have an interest like this, to be grateful to have that kind of interest, and to
Well, the Shastra tries to make you realize how special you are.
Huh?
Oh, the Shastra will try to make you realize how special you are. But that's part of the Indian tradition. Like, say you're a musician, and you're studying the, you know, or a dancer, and you're studying with a guru, that particular Shastra, there will be, you know, prayers evoking all of the Bhagavan in the form of this music, in the form of this Shastra, and also blessing the wonderful student, you know, so that the student also feels special within that tradition. You know, and in Vedanta too, so that you recognize as a mumukshu that is something special, and it's very sacred also. And also the student, there's all kinds of prayers where the student sees the guru as more precious than my eyes. You know, there's so many different prayers praising the teacher. But then also there's prayers which tell how the teacher holds the student, you know, as some precious jewel. So there's all these type of prayers, you know, and verses.
But there's a truth in that.
There's a truth in it, yeah.
And to have a teacher, I mean, that's got to be pretty rare to have a qualified teacher.
Yeah, well, actually, what the Shastra says there, which I think is, I trust it anyway, that if you are a mumukshu, you will get a teacher, if you're a mumukshu. A teacher means, we shouldn't have to say qualified. you should get somebody who is actually a teacher. Yeah. If you are a mumukshu. If you're not a mumukshu, then you will get what's appropriate for you. But if you're a mumukshu, then you'll get, the Shastras say, the tradition says, you'll get your teacher at that time. You know, and I trust that. You know, so there's so many unfoldments around that. Well, just like Bhagavan, you know, gave you lungs but no air. He forgot about the air. You know? He gave you thirst, but he forgot about the water. So he gave every human being this, you know, longing to be whole, to be complete, you know, but no means of attaining that. Even though that need is ubiquitous for every being, you know, let me be happy. You know, let me be happy, let me be free from sorrow. Let me be whole and free. We're all seekers in one way or another. And at some point, what makes a mumukshu is when you realize I'm not able to achieve this wholeness in the world. Not because I'm deficient, but because the world is not able to do it. It can't happen. And so, but that recognition should be rewarded, you know, with an answer. Where you throw up your hands, is there a way?
So is that the moment where one actually becomes a mumukshu? I mean, is that when you really see there's nothing to be gained outside of oneself?
Well, you could either drop dead in despair. But the mumukshutvam assumes a relationship with Bhagavan, where you believe that there is something greater. Because if you know, that you believe there's a Bhagavan that you can throw your hands up to and say, please save me, what is the truth? You know, but say your response of your buddhi is just that, that's the nature of reality. There's no, you know, and then that's just despair. You know, I'm trying to figure out something. But that would be mumukshutvam. Mumukshutvam means, it comes from the root much, you know, to be free, to be released. So mumukshu is the one, it's a desiderative nominal formation in Sanskrit. You know the mumu, mumukshu, and see that kshu, that sa, kshu, then jignyasu, that jijji, that jignyasu, Those are desiderative. Jignasu is the one who desires to know, to have knowledge. Mumukshu is the one who desires liberation. You know, so that the desire for is included in that nominal affects, which allows for that reduplication, like the mumu and jignasu and bubukshu.
Carol, this thing about, you know, having a relationship with the Ishta Devata.
Yeah.
That's very interesting to me because I'm not so used to, you know, trying to decide on a form. I mean, even though I've done that in meditations like that, it's not...
But you can do it with Brahman.
You could do it with Nirguna.
Yeah, definitely.
But I was actually doing an experimenting with the form, and it's interesting because for me, you know, the form would sort of shift. Like, there's a few different...
Yeah.
There's a few different forms.
Yeah.
So it'd be,
use them all.
Why not, right? Yeah, yeah. Becoming a Hindu.
But, you know, even in the Buddhist, there's Tara and there's Kuan Yin.
No, definitely,
many.
Yeah,
there's so
Buddhists.
Many that
mm-hmm.
you can come into relationship with.
Exactly.
Who are much bigger than you in terms
right.
of their knowledge and their power and all these.
The nice thing
lessons.
About the form to some degree is that this is... in terms of dealing with your unconscious and with your desires and with your needs and wants and things like that,
yeah.
it seems easier maybe to communicate that to either a male or female figure, or, you know, friend or mother or father type figure or something like that.
Yeah, it can be, you know, but you can be still doing it to a relational figure, but not have an image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's still a relational figure.
What did you say?
You can be doing it to a relational figure, and it can be auditory. It's not necessarily that you see a form. It depends on
mm-hmm.
how visual your mind is.
Okay.
You know, you can have a relationship with Ishvara, you know, where you're having that dialogue, but there's no form there. There's just a dialogue. Or for some people, there's a form.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's visual.
Right.
So,
well, is it okay if it's just pretend?
Yeah,
well,
because nothing's pretend in the unpsyche. It's not really pretend. In fact, that idea
of
it
feels like pretend to do this particular part of the exercise.
You know what I would do, because that's a problem Jung used to have. That stopped him from doing it. Oh, I'm just making this up, or I'm just, this is just pretend. Finally, he just said, just go ahead and pretend. Don't worry about it. That allows you to just do the exercise where that's not. That evaluative piece is not necessary.
Well, and also following up on that, if this is off topic, we can save it, but it's my usual hang up. So, Ishvara, why does Ishvara have a gender, and why is it male?
well,
actually, all creation
actually,
is prakriti.
I mean, you've been referring.
I would say Brahman. Brahman is neuter.
Okay.
Ishvara as Ishvara, that is masculine. Maya is feminine. And so, in the end, what we would say is for Ishvara, what the contents of Ishvara is masculine and feminine equally. Like the men are part of Ishvara, women, the feminine is part of Ishvara. Right, and so. Atma is a masculine noun. Brahman is a neuter noun. Ishvara, which is Brahman neuter, plus Maya feminine, is Ishvara masculine. And so the masculine is not the same as the Christian male god. You see what I mean? We would say within Ishvara there are masculine devatas and feminine devatas, you know, feminine deities, masculine deities. And so why is Ishvara masculine? I don't know that there's
why
is Maya feminine, why is Atma masculine, why is Brahman feminine, no Brahman neuter, you see what I mean?
Yeah, I don't understand why they're not all neuter.
Isn't it not so that we can have a relationship with them because we're embodied and it's helpful to have
yeah.
a relationship with some concept of something that is some kind of a reflection of what some people just have a preference to have built to kind of lean into something that they can visualize as masculine or feminine.
But there is mass. See, that's the thing within the relational world. There's within Ishwara, there's masculine and feminine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have a relationship with Maya, the goddess, the mother. You know, or a relationship with Ishwara. But I don't know if I can really answer your question. Except that the way I'm answering, I don't have any more depth. The Swamiji might go more into it.
It just seems like, I mean, the simplest is that, you know, there is no boundary to divinity. There's no, there really is beyond quality. So
yeah,
masculine sex, and so sex is a quality. So if you think of beyond qualities and inclusive of qualities also, which is Ishwara, you know, then sex is no longer an issue because it's not bound by a body. The body is simply a device for, you know, evoking devotion. That's all.
And even the body is both. It's just a matter of where, you know, it takes over to one or the other.
There is one image of Bhagavan.
There's that.
Adinara Shiva.
Yeah.
Half
masculine.
Oh, yeah.
Half
yeah.
One image, half yeah. masculine, half feminine. Yeah. What's it called?
Adinara Shiva, I think.
Something like that. Ardha
means
half. Ardha means half.
Yeah, so it has to be
Ardha. Adinara or Adinari Shiva.